Welcome to Hidden Layers, where we explore the people and technology behind artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Ron Green. I'm excited to be joined today by Cole Complice. Cole is the Chief Information Officer at the University of Texas at Austin, a leading institution renowned for its innovation in education, technology, and research. Cole has spent over 25 years driving digital transformation and technology strategy adoption at some of the most prominent institutions in America. We're going to discuss how AI is reshaping higher education, from the promise of personalized learning tools to the challenges of investing in a rapidly advancing technology like artificial intelligence. Whether you're curious about AI's impact on education or how to integrate AI into your organization, you won't want to miss this conversation. As CIO of the University of Texas at Austin, Cole leads the university's technology strategy, collaborating with stakeholders to support research, teaching, and community needs. He has decades of IT leadership experience in private and public research universities and is recognized for his innovation, team building, and driving successful digital transformations. He previously served as CIO at Northeastern University and held leadership roles at the University of Chicago, Stony Brook, and Penn State. He holds degrees from West Virginia University and Bloomsburg University of Pennsylvania. Welcome, Cole.
It's good to be here. Thanks.
All right. I want to kick off with how AI is different. You've got this really, really long, successful career. You've navigated the internet revolution. You navigated the mobile revolution. Now we're in what I believe to be the most disruptive revolution, technologically speaking, that we'll see in our lifetimes. How is it the same? How is it different? And how are you thinking about this going forward at this early stage?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And I think at the end of the day, strategy is strategy. And I know that that sounds really basic. But, you know, when I first walked into higher education, we were in this moment where we were moving from delivering content, educational content, everything on CD-ROMs. Mm-hmm. And then this free network showed up. Right. And we all sort of looked at each other and thought, you know, it might be interesting to use it for something that could change the world. And I think we looked at it that way, maybe because we were all sort of young and the internet was connecting us at the same time. But it was exciting. And we sat around for a number of years watching the internet sort of in this stagnant role. And then we had the real switch, I think, is not just the dawn of the internet, but sort of the dawn of the read-write web when people took control over content and democratized the delivery of information. Mobility really was not in the same sort of disruptive space. I mean, and I think of disruption as a very positive thing, right? Especially disruptive innovation, disruptive technologies. The internet the rise of mobile extended that reach, right? Now you could share something with the world with a device that walked around in your pocket. I think where AI is taking us and why it's disruptive in a very different way is it's been around a long time, but it's still very mysterious to people. Mm-hmm. It is, by and large, the subject of science fiction many of us grew up with. So even though it's this technology that can really transform, I believe, every single dimension of society, it's sort of arrived on the scene with a reputation.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right? So you have people who have false notions of what AI has been, what it is, and what it's going to be based on, you know, popular science fiction, media, et cetera. And I think in a weird way, it's holding some people back from exploring it as thoroughly as they possibly could.
That's a really interesting point because, you know, most technology waves don't come to widespread awareness with so much baggage.
Right.
I've never really thought about it like that before. Like when the internet revolution happened, that was all about connecting people, making sort of content distribution costs go to zero. Yeah. But there wasn't really a lot of baggage associated with that. A lot of people are worried. They think about AI and they almost, you know, they simultaneously think about talking robots and Terminator.
Well, that's it. You know, not to be, you know, go too Ted Lasso on you, but you know, the quote that I've adopted through all this is be curious, not judgmental. Because I've watched that almost dominance of, oh my God, the world is about ready to fall apart on this. And we've seen all of this. Like, you know, do you remember when the iPad came out and everybody said it's going to save education?
Yes.
Right? Absolutely. Steve Jobs was going to revolutionize textbooks and no one was ever going to carry a paper-based book again. It didn't happen.
It did not.
The other half of those people said it would destroy education. I think we're in that moment again with AI.
Yeah.
Where too many people, and I think it's more than half, are focusing on, boy, there's the end of originality. There's the end of creative thought. And while that's true in some ways, I mean, I have kids. I watch how they use ChatGPT. I don't think it's fundamentally breaking their desire to do hard work, though. Mm-hmm. I think what it's doing is the same thing it's doing for all of us. It's augmenting their intelligence. And I think that the AI, really, you could swap in and out augmentation for artificial pretty easily. And I think that that's what we're going to see from an adoption perspective. People are going to start dipping their toes into it in a meaningful way once they realize that it's like having a really smart friend walking around with you at all times.
Yes.
And as you get over this idea that it's destroying your ability to think creatively or to think critically, you realize it gets you closer to the final moment of your analysis. And it lets you ask better questions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like the notion that one of the products of great research is the ability to ask even better questions,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
AI drives me to ask deeper, better questions in my decision making.
I really share your optimism here, especially around the idea that we could have these AI systems that would be with us 24/7 and acting in a way to just, you know, be looking out for us and or providing a guidance or context or advice. Mm-hmm. You know, without naming names or anything like that, what is the general view within not just the University of Texas at sure. Austin, but across the different campuses, your colleagues across the country? What is the view about AI? Is there mostly excitement? Is there mostly fear? We joked before about the combination of terror and excitement.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, terror and excitement. I think that that's sort of generally where people are in this moment right now. I mean, I think that you have folks like myself who are CIOs, chief digital officers, et cetera, who are recognizing the power of this and are working really hard to learn as much as they can to overcome the negative noise and project a little bit less of the fear and a little bit more of the optimism. I don't quite think that the general population of higher education really understands like what you just said there, that you can walk around with a personal assistant that's not just there waiting for you, but can nudge you. And I think that when this moves to the next level where it's automated, like today, excuse me, I took an Uber over here. My watch instantly changed modalities because it's beginning to think for me. Mm-hmm. It's beginning to think for what I want it to do. You're seeing those little things show up. And the other thing that I think is going to change that perception is, you know, it's not going to be too long here until everybody gets this new iOS update.
Yes.
Right? And people start initiating this Apple intelligence thing. So we're going from this world where it's the domain of the technologists, and we are literally skipping to full audience adoption
mm-hmm.
in a way that I've not seen with any other technology.
I completely agree. I think it's about to be a major, major event because it will now be embedded on the most deployed device in human history,
that's
which
right.
is the smartphone. Okay, I've got a couple of really, really interesting topics I want to get your take on. So this is not limited to higher education. Every organization, every business is facing this challenge, which is how do you balance between centralizing oversight and control of AI deployments and innovation, right? So on the one hand, you want centralization for governance, right? There are real issues around that, around data and privacy. But at the same time, if you have too much centralization, you stifle innovation. And, you know, the University of Texas is such a large organization here in Austin. I would imagine that that dynamic is something that is central to the way you're thinking about your AI strategy.
Well, it is the strategy, right? That's the basis of how I want to approach this. I'm a firm believer in implementation of common platforms. So from a technology perspective, it's easy for people to recognize that through something like Microsoft 365, right? That's an implementation of a platform. We learned through years of trying to manage email servers in every college of the university, right? You know, like when I showed up at the University of Chicago as CIO only, you know, not even 10 years ago, every division had its own email server.
Wow.
Right. And that's in the world of cloud services. They were still holding on to that.
Yeah.
Somewhere along the line, we finally got to the point where IT leaders started to think that, okay, maybe I shouldn't be doing all this commodity stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we, by and large, adopted centralized platforms for these things. So we've moved to the point in higher education where the network is a central asset, authentication and identity is a central asset. Collaboration is now fully integrated on our campuses in a way, thanks to the pandemic in large part, that have just driven platform thinking.
Right.
And I think if you're trying to be an IT leader today in any organization and you're not thinking about how you gain economies of scale by doing platform plays, I think you're in for a world of hurt.
Right.
Like, legit. That does not preclude you from saying to Macomb School of Business, hey, you guys have very special needs over here. You should do that, right? Now, we will provide you with a common platform so that if you want to be able to learn how to use AI on one system with endpoints in place so you can connect to data, with data protection in place, with guardrails and all the things that we do from a platform perspective, it's here. And you can drive economies of scale. And that platform, by the way, is a stage. Right. So when you think about a platform allows you to mount additional activities on top of it. So even a building, I think of as a platform on campus, right? Because a building allows you to do various things. You can launch programs, academic programs in that space. You can host events. These are vertically integrated activities that live on your platform. So with AI, I think it's critical, especially at a place like the University of Austin, which is a city in and of itself, that there is a consistent one layer that runs intelligence across the campus.
Mm-hmm.
Because we do have products in that space, right? Zoom has an intelligent agent. Copilot are a set of intelligent agents, which, by the way, just run on top of the M365 platform, right? What I would like to do is create a robust baseline foundation for AI to exist at the university. The governance is there really around data protection and impacting the enterprise. And what I mean by that is we don't want individuals outside of the center being able to write data to our systems of record. Right? They're systems of record. So you do have governance in that layer, even if you allow people to bring things in and stack them on top of the platform. But I don't think universities can afford to let 1,000 flowers bloom. It's especially in these early days. We're not used to paying this much money for individual licenses of products, right? So especially at scale, we have over 50,000 undergraduate students.
Right.
You know, $20 a month gets pretty expensive.
Yeah. All right. Let me say this back to you because I think you made some really, really great points. You're balancing, obviously, centralization with innovation. And part of that is to make sure that you provide a platform sort of for core common needs across all the different colleges and departments, but you don't want to necessarily invest on technologies that don't provide a differentiation, right? You don't want to be you know building your own email capabilities. Those are commoditized. They don't provide differentiation. But then with that platform, that common platform, each of the institutions or the divisions can then innovate in their own way, knowing that they have this foundation they're building on.
Yeah, they can solve their problems of practice.
Okay.
Right? And so that's the way that I'm looking at this right now. In the early days, you know, can we revolutionize operations with AI? Of course, but it's going to take time. It's like anything. It's not like magic. Mm-hmm. It's still work.
Yes.
You know, it's gratifying, but it takes a mindset. It takes an analyst mindset to understand challenges. But it allows a college to solve their local problems using AI without investing in the technology themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, there will be chargeback models and other things that meter their utilization of the tokens. But at the end of the day, it's really about everybody having the common availability. And I mean everybody. You know, my vision for this is that our undergraduate students, all the way through our PhD, doctoral students, our faculty, our staff, everybody should have access to these tools, because we have a chance to not do what we did with mobility, with one-to-one initiatives and other things. You know, widen the digital divide.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel, especially working at UT Austin, which is a state university, it's the ethos of educating the citizens of the state are, you know, it's baked into who we are. And if you take the folks that can't afford this, you're just widening that same gap that they've lived with their whole lives.
Let's talk about that a little bit more. There is a lot of fear out there that AI will widen that gap between the haves and the haves not, mm-hmm. the have-nots. One of the ways that AI could potentially level the playing field is through the deployment of more personalized learning tools. But there could also be barriers to that adoption, right? Imagine if you're a student and you needed, I don't know, you needed a smartphone to have access to these technologies, right. But you couldn't even afford one. This is I know this is something that the university takes very, very seriously. How do you think about it? Do you consider this like one of the main responsibilities as a CIO to make sure that you keep the playing field as level as possible for all of the students at the university?
I mean, I feel that way. I don't know that all of our universities have historically behaved that way. I mean, think of the post-tuition costs. We could spend a day talking about how expensive education really is, well beyond the notion of financial aid, right? The post-tuition investment is massive. And, you know, I think AI is one of those technologies, like digital textbooks is another one that has not taken hold. There are significant barriers to it. You know, students don't love them. Faculty don't often choose them, which is the biggest reason. But think of how that just reduces the cost of your post-tuition life. But then you have rent, you have food, all these things that go into it. I don't understand why we would add another set of dollars on top of all that to level that playing field. These kids are going to be in the marketplace in three, 4 years. I mean, I think it's my job to make sure that they have the skills that a contemporary organization would require of them. The days of walking into work and not understanding this stuff are over.
Yes.
It's over.
I agree.
I mean, I can't imagine an industry that is not going to be, I mean, even from the basics. I mean, if you own a tire shop, the basics of supply chain management and inventory control will be revolutionized by AI. Those folks will be using AI embedded in ADP tools delivered to them on yep. green screens, and they won't even know it.
Right.
They won't even know why their shipments are changing of their inventory,
mm-hmm.
because it will just happen. And you're going to need people that think that way.
This is a challenge that every organization out there is facing, and it's a question that we get asked a lot at Kung Fu AI, which is, how do you balance investing into artificial intelligence when it's moving this quickly? I have been through, like you, many technological waves, And I've never seen one move this fast. AI is moving at just a blistering pace. And the danger is you go invest a bunch of money, maybe millions of dollars,
yeah, sure,
into some capability, some custom capability, let's say for students, like some personalized learning tool. And then a year later, that is some offering that's baked in. It's just a feature of some tool that you're paying for, that some cloud compute tool you're paying for. And maybe you have to walk away from that multi-million dollar investment. How do you manage making decisions around investment when things are moving this damn fast?
Yeah, I mean, it's the new thing that keeps me up at night. Really, you know, usually CIOs say it's bad guys doing bad things, cybersecurity. But this one is really difficult. And I think that you have to make a decision that you're either going to participate and lead, or you're going to wait it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think waiting it out and not having a central strategy from the office of the CIO, supported by the president, supported by the provost, you're inviting the idea that there will be 1,000 flowers planted because no one else is going to wait.
Right.
Deans in the colleges are not going to wait if we say, no, you know, it's expensive. We can't really use this to make a difference. They're going to make a difference. They're going to run their businesses. I don't think people really have really understand how universities really operate. And it's very interesting where deans are essentially CEOs of their own little colleges. Right. So the dean of liberal arts generates revenue just like you would expect it to. And then she gets to make decisions with that revenue. She can decide who she wants to hire. Does she want to hire faculty? Does she want to hire staff? Like, it's a really interesting thing. Well, one of the things they do with that money is they invest in technology. I mean, that's the other thing people don't know about higher ed is that I don't control anybody's money on campus. Right. I have a central allocation that I try to think about strategy to support everybody, but it doesn't preclude them from doing their own thing. If I sit back and say, we're not doing this, we're going to have 13 or 14 licenses of artificial intelligence for Zoom. We're going to have 13 or 14 OpenAI engagements. We're going to have, you know, Dell will come to campus and sell it. Apple will come to campus and sell it. Microsoft will come to campus and sell it. So I feel as the CIO, I need to make a very important decision around what is best for everyone at the common good layer, right?
Yeah.
And if I give them a very flexible, agile, common good layer that allows us to pivot in 6 months' time or in 12 months' time, we do that. You know, in central IT, we end up in the world of technical debt a lot. And I don't, again, you know, it's the stuff that we did 20 years ago that's like the duct tape and, right, you know, chicken wire that's holding a lot of times the data pipelines together,
mm-hmm,
right? Or old servers that we have to maintain or old databases that have to be maintained. You know, we know how to do that, right? And we know how to manage our technical debt out and how to manage new technology in. That's what we do. We live in that. That's a business, right? We're running a business.
Right.
That's our business. I don't think that the colleges run their businesses that way. Their business is discovery of knowledge and the education of young minds,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Along with fundraising and all the other things that they do. But their business is not really to run technology. They have a CIO who does that. So if I sit it out, it doesn't just put the university behind, it wastes far more money in the aggregate.
Right.
I can negotiate at scale, right? I can allow access to certain researchers for certain companies who want to make a difference. You know, I have a lot that I can broker to bring the total cost of ownership down. And then again, if we go back to the concept of a common platform, I can invest in training for that platform. I can invest for data pipelines for that platform. I can create an environment where 70% of the work on campus can be managed via the central platform, and then allow those colleges to invest their money where it makes sense. And it's going to be bespoke, right? Law school's going to go after this and say, we need AI technology that helps educate our, you know, emerging attorneys to be attorneys in the 21st century with AI. Mm-hmm. You know, they're going to be specialized platforms. Discipline-specific platforms need to exist, and they always have. And it's why I think IT exists in the center to provide the common good. And common good should be common great. And then you have the colleges who have to focus on what differentiates them. Mm-hmm. Remember, the colleges need to be differentiated as well, just as the university does. The colleges enjoy rankings just like the university does.
Right.
And so their investment strategy is critical to differentiating them in their marketplace. And my investment strategy is about differentiating the university in the marketplace.
I can't help but think that the whole time you were answering that question, the CIOs listening to this right now are just vigorously nodding their head, right? It's like, oh yeah, that's my life entirely.
Yeah, and I think too many of us get frustrated about, oh, what's this dean doing and why is she doing this to me? She's not. She's operating in her marketplace to try to make a differentiated decision. Right. To raise the reputation of her college, to attract higher quality faculty, to attract higher quality students. When that happens, knowledge production goes through the roof,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm more interested in working on the things that I can control. I spend my energy there and less time on governance of them trying to make their world better.
Right, right.
Why would I ever want to challenge a dean's decision-making? Now, if she's making a decision that is detrimental to the university, you know, we have controls in place for that.
Right, right.
But I don't care about drawing a line in the sand on this one. You have to.
All right. I want to ask you a question that is unique, I think, to education. This is not something that most organizations are dealing with. I've heard it said, you know, kind of in jest that we are living in what some call the golden age of cheating. If you're a student right now, it has never been easier to kind of subvert the traditional learning assessment methodologies that we have out there. I know you have some great thoughts on this. Where do you see we're going with this and AI and cheating?
Well, I mean, I think if you're going to say we're in the golden age of cheating, does it mean we're in the dark ages of assessment? And, you know, because assessment is the other side of that coin.
Right.
I mean, and I think what it's going to do is it's going to force our hand around more authentic assessment. Right now, we're using more like avoidance theory. We're making students go back to blue books. Right? Write out their essay responses so they don't have access to their computer. We're sort of retreating back to some of the practices that we used to
use. All right, that is fascinating. I did not know that. Like, you're going back to my days in college.
Well, mine too, right?
That's incredible.
You know, when you could stuff your blue book in the middle of a pile and nobody knew who you were in your 350-person class. You know, cheating is like crime, it's like water, right? It's going to find a way.
Right.
You know, when I was at Penn State, we built one of the first secure testing facilities for assessment, and it was all computerized. Talk about millions of dollars, right? And the students would walk in and they would get a blue bag that had a lock on it. All their things would go in that. That would go in a locker.
Oh, wow.
They'd be handed a stack of white paper and a pencil, and then they'd go in without anything else, and they'd sit down at a computer that we had built the software so that it would lock them out of anything but the secure browser. They would take their exam, and when they'd walk out, they'd have to turn in their scratch paper. That's the way assessment's been going on college campuses.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, you have to find new modalities and models, new mindsets and new practice. I still think this, every disruptive technology forces people to understand new ways of using it. The chalkboard in 1855 was probably one of the most disruptive pieces of technology introduced into classrooms ever. Because think about it. For the first time ever, a teacher had to turn her back on her students. Right? That's a trust thing, man, that is, you know, there wasn't teacher education to support those technologies either. Teachers write on chalkboards with big loopy letters. Like you think, oh, they all write the same. No, that's a pedagogical practice to better utilize the affordances of what a chalkboard is.
Oh, fascinating.
A chalkboard was a portable device before we had mobile phones. Students had them in the classroom as well to work their math problems and their spell. They could pass notes for the first time. They could broadcast messages around rooms, right? So we have been doing this over and over and over again. The notion of disruption, it takes time to unpack the affordances of the technology, and that leads to a change in teaching practice. And so right now, if we're in the golden age of cheating, then it's fair to say maybe we're in the dark ages of assessment because we've not yet put these tools in the classrooms and College of Education's allowed faculty to research them, unpack the affordances, and start to deliver new instructional methods for people to take advantage of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you didn't see this coming, you've not been watching. I mean, Christ, the iPad is Star Trek, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I mean, if you've not been paying attention to where all this is going, you're caught off guard. This is not like something that just happened last week. I mean, we're 40, 50 years into this. And it's just been a slow progression. And now we're at the place where we're back to, hey, let's think about how do we ask these kids questions that doesn't allow them to just get the answer out of thin air? It's harder.
I love it.
Technology makes for hard work.
Well, all right. I want to ask you about collaboration at the CIO level. So I had the pleasure of chatting with Katia Walsh, the chief digital officer at Harvard Business School earlier this week. And she was sharing how challenging it is right now for everybody in her role, like you, to figure out exactly the best moves with AI strategy and how there's need for more collaboration. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on the idea that these large, you know, premier institutions should be collaborating more? Because I understand there's obviously the competitive edge, right? There is the differentiation sometimes can be driven by not collaborating.
Well, yeah, but that's also, you know, again, I mean, I hate to be so non-controversial, but, you know, I talk to my peers constantly. You know, I was on a call yesterday with all the CIOs across the state system of Texas, and every one of them is thinking about AI. Every one of them is thinking about their strategy and their play, even if that strategy and play is we don't have the money right now to do this. The more we have those conversations, the better. EDUCAUSE is coming up in a couple of weeks in San Antonio, premier higher ed, you know, IT conference. I guarantee you, if you look at the program, and there'll be 10,000 people there, the whole program will be dominated by AI and AI strategy discussions.
I believe it.
Gartner Symposium is going on at the same time. There'll be 20,000 people there. 75% of the sessions will be about AI. 50% of them will be about procurement of AI, right? So I think the lonely days are coming to an end. I think the story is bubbling up. I think you're going to see people finally realize that these are enterprise class applications that can serve you as an individual or room 16,000 sections of classes every semester across 356 general purpose classrooms in 3 minutes.
Right.
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 So to me, if you're not playing with it, understanding it, spend your own, here's some advice. Get your own OpenAI ChatGPT license. If your school is not going to pay for it and you're a CIO, pull out your freaking credit card.
I totally agree.
I mean, it's what, 20, 30 bucks a month? Pull out your credit card and understand what's going on.
Right.
What's actually happening is so much more profound. The opportunity is so much bigger than we're talking about. Everything we do at a university, everything you do in a corporation, every city planner, everyone can move faster with more accuracy and more precision if they understand the basics of generative AI.
All right, that is a perfect segue to the last question I wanted to ask you, which is just on a personal note, like, how do you use AI both at work and at home? Do you have any tips? Do you have any favorite AI tools that you use?
Favorite tools? Yeah, right now I'm enamored with ChatGPT.
I totally agree.
And I don't subscribe to the holy wars of technology either, right? So that's Mac versus PC or Android versus, who gives a shit?
Right.
Sorry, everybody out there.
No, totally agree.
Sorry, listener. You know, I think that at the end of the day, you have to just buck up and go. And ChatGPT, the personal GPTs, the custom GPTs are so much fun to interact with. They're so much fun to work with. So how am I using it? I have a digital twin, right? I just started at UT Austin 6 months ago. And, you know, with a VP job, you get like this big packet of what's the job all about. You know, I got all that data. I have about 2,000 pages of consultant work that has gone on in the 2 years leading up to me being hired. I have an organizational chart. I have my financial documents. I've trained a GPT to be me. So I can ask it questions about my organization. I can actually ask it about opportunities that I have, and it will help me lay out strategy to achieve it.
And just to be clear for people that are listening who may not know what you're talking about, these personal GPTs, what you can do is you can take in a bunch of text or a bunch of documents and give it context about who you are, what your job is, what your responsibilities are, maybe a lot of information about the institution, and it's there in context. So anytime you're interacting with that language model, it understands everything that you think it needs to know about you to optimize
there,
output.
Right?
Starting point.
So if
exactly.
you use the free version of ChatGPT, you know, you go in and you ask, pretend you're a chef and I would like the best recipe for, you know, you give it a little context, but that's a session.
Yes.
You go away.
You're one and done.
Yeah. It doesn't remember you're a chef, that you want you to be a chef. However, you could create a cooking custom GPT where you might upload, you know, one of the seminal cookbooks that you find online in the open domain, right? You might, and you tell it everything about it. And it'll remember all that. So it starts from that place.
Yes.
So imagine being able to deploy custom GPTs across dashboards in just very specific areas on a campus. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic.
So it's funny. This is actually my favorite use of AI right now. I have dozens.
Yes, boy.
I have dozens of custom GPTs that are specialized to different sort of different tasks or use cases I need, and it saves so much time.
Yep. I mean, you asked me about how do I use it on a personal level, and it's really funny. I hadn't thought about, like, you know, for somebody who tries to be a great dad and a decent husband, you know, I don't have a GPT for that yet. I mean, I used it the other day. My daughter is a senior at Northeastern University in Boston, and she was talking about one of her courses and said something along the lines, when did Christians decide that they no longer wanted to have a stake in Israel? And so she started looking and stuff. So I went over to ChatGPT and I asked, you know, succinctly, and she got pissed at me. She was like, you ruined the fun there. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know how you use it personally in that way. I mean,
each person will just have their own.
I think what's magical about it is that any problem of practice, in your personal life or in your public life or in your work life, if you sit there for a few minutes, you can start to move your way toward a tool that helps you accomplish your goals.
Yeah, I totally agree.
But I think it's really, what I like about it is it makes you think critically, right? So I think your critical thinking skills go up as you start designing custom GPTs. What will make a difference in this decision-making? What can I help this thing learn to get better about my context?
Mm-hmm.
But I find it very strange that I think that this is really fun stuff.
Well, I really enjoy it too. And maybe it's, maybe that's the peculiar quirk that makes us suited for the roles we play. Who knows? Right?
I don't know.
I don't know.
I mean, remember when I was a kid and the Apple II was a computer, there were these games that were like, you could talk to.
Yes.
And they would text you. They would message you back.
Oh, yeah, right? Absolutely.
And you'd be like, this is unbelievable. And then you'd get the same answer again, like after you've asked it 20 questions or something. And you'd be like, oh, I see what's going on here. Yeah, it's a loop. It's an array. This is BS.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen.
Those days are over, man.
That doesn't happen anymore.
Oh, my God. All right, Cole, thank you so much for being here. This was a fantastically fun conversation. Thank you so much.
Anytime. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Hidden Layers. This series is hosted by Kung Fu AI, a management consulting and engineering firm focused exclusively on artificial intelligence. If you have any questions or thoughts about today's episode, or if you know someone we should feature, please visit us at kungfu.ai.